but then also allowing myself to let go of this like rigid, robotic, focused athlete image, because you don't have to be like that. And sometimes it works for people, but sometimes letting yourself smile, or, you know, give eye contact with someone that's watching you that you know maybe, or when someone gives you a big cheer, kind of giving them a fist back, or, you know, responding to that and then receiving even more energy from them. For me, I felt more energized by that. So I didn't feel like I lost any energy from, you know, I wouldn't even say losing focus, but kind of breaking this metronomic kind of furrowed brow look, if you like. But it's balancing it. So obviously you can't do that throughout the whole race. And especially in the earlier stages, if you're constantly shouting back and raising your arms for more cheers, like, it will tire you out. And I think it's something that's best saved for when you need it most and when it gives you that momentum. So for me, it was sort of a little bit of that halfway point. And then,
hello friends, welcome to, or welcome back to, A Runner's Life podcast. In this episode, welcome back to Philly Bowden, who I originally spoke to in episode 121, following her marathon debut in Sevilla. Sometimes I say Sevilla, sometimes I say Seville. Yeah, I don't know what happened. I think my brain is alternates between the two, and that's life. So let's just roll on. In this episode, we speak about her recent marathon in Copenhagen, where she set a new PB and she came third place. But we also fill in the gaps between what happened in the first episode to where she is now, the updates in her life, the changes, and we also take your questions. So thank you to everyone that's sending questions, covering things from training to dealing with nerves pre-race to dealing with how to find a running club and also how to deal with imposter syndrome. So in this episode, I want to make it clear that if you want to see the breakdown of the race and the training that went into it, Philly goes into detail about this on her YouTube page, and also she did a really great breakdown of the race on her Instagram page, so you can have a look at that. This conversation is mainly focused on the mental preparation pre-race, during race, and a lot of things I think that the amateur runners can take from this as well, not just the elites. If there's something in this episode that resonates with you, please do share it with your community. It really does help the podcast grow. Thank you to people that support the show, patrons, people that send me messages and DMs highlighting specific parts of different episodes that resonate with you, particularly a recent episode with Jerry Sun. I've got a lot of good feedback from that, so thank you to everyone that's listened to that. I really enjoyed this conversation. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did recording it. And with that being said, let's head to the conversation with Philly. Hi, Philly. Welcome back to A Runner's Life podcast. How are you doing?
Hey, I'm good, thank you. Thanks so much for having me back on.
No, I appreciate you coming back. We first spoke back in episode 121 when you ran your marathon debut in Sevilla. And now you've recently completed your second marathon, running a PB of 2:29 and finishing third place in Copenhagen. So again, thanks for joining me for part two.
Yeah, gosh, that seems like an absolute lifetime ago, running in Seville. I can't believe it's only been like, what, a year and a few months?
Yeah. A lot of things have changed since then, especially for you as well.
Mm.
You're working full time and then things have changed. So I don't know if you can sort of give us like a little bit of a high level summary of like what's been the differences between Seville and Copenhagen.
Yeah, so in terms of my life around running, I suppose, I've moved from Reading to Manchester. I have quit my job as a full-time civil servant. I'm now self-employed, full-time athlete, coach, content creator. I am part of Team New Balance Manchester. And yeah, what else has changed? I think that's it. Not much.
I want to talk about the team New Balance in Manchester, but I just, I only just thought about this, but you've got the best initials for, you know, a runner, PB. I mean, do you feel any pressure to have to get any races?
I slightly hope my parents thought about that, but when I was a kid, it was, we were laughing about my full set of initials because my dad was a police officer. So we used to joke that if I ever joined the police force, I would be PC Bowden, because my middle name is Claire. So there you go. I've got that on my initials as well.
It's still time, though, to become a police officer. You never know.
Yeah, who knows? After running, you've got a whole other career ahead of you.
Oh, gosh. Can you imagine if someone would try to make a getaway and you were there just like, this is not going to be your day.
I'd have to keep training, wouldn't I?
You would have to, yeah. Can you talk a little bit about Team New Balance in Manchester as well?
Yeah, so I felt in a really fortunate position actually when I sort of voiced that I'd like to join the team, because my coach, who I've been working with for a couple of years at that point, Helen Clitheroe, she joined the team as a assistant coach and then has found herself in the spot where she's head coach. Steve Vernon left to work at British Athletics, and I just sort of said to her, if there was ever the opportunity for me to join the team, I would absolutely bite your hand off. And the conditions, obviously with them being based up here, meant that to do that I needed to move up here. So all I had to do was convince my partner, who luckily, like, he was really on board with it, and we both then set about, yeah, selling our little house that we were doing up in Reading and moved up here. And yeah, the setup is really cool. I live about a mile down the road from the athlete house where a decent bunch of the team live together. And we've got the track really nearby. We've got a massage therapist who we see. She comes to us twice a week. Vicky, she's amazing. We've got physio support. It's just a really cool place to be where you can train with people that are all invested in the same journey, but a different journey. We're all training for different events and distances, but it gives you, yeah, someone to share that with, because sometimes once you're sort of grown up, if you like, and not in the university system or the college system out in America, you can find yourself training on your own a lot, especially if you're trying to sort of fit it in around a full-time job. So yeah, it's been pretty life-changing, really.
That's pretty cool to hear, because I was asked the other day about UK teams that had like a female focus. And I thought of your team, and is that something that's kind of becoming more common, or has it always been like not as common in the UK, so to speak?
Yeah, I think it's you know, things are always moving in the right direction in that space, having female coaches at the helm. I saw a story on BBC Sport the other day with the first female coach in the Men's Premier League, which is really cool, but then also surprising that it's taken that long, you know. So it is cool, and it's I love having Helen as a coach, in the sense that she's been to the places that I want to go to. She's been to the Olympics, been to the World Championships. She's been a British record holder. She's got the experience from being an athlete, and she's a fantastic coach. And being a female as well, there's things that she understands to an extra level, I think, that maybe you can't get from having a male coach.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm actually doing the UK Athletics Endurance Coaching qualification, and they actually did a section where they're talking about a coach, and he went, he. And in my head, I went automatically, they, because how do you know it's going to be a he? You know, yeah. It's a sort of show. So even how current systems that we're using are still a bit outdated.
Yeah, it's funny. I, weirdly, slightly going off a tangent, I saw that in reference to like cats recently. Okay. I was looking online for a way that I could help one of my cats who's a little bit anxious when we have visitors, and throughout this article they referred to the cat in question, or your cat, as a he, and I was like, no, she's a she, like, why are we assuming that the cat's a he here? So I think, I mean, yeah, that's just a silly story, but I think in a lot of industries and sport especially, sometimes, you know, that still is the default, which is a real shame, but you've just got to call people up on it and challenge it, because, you know, there's plenty of fantastic female athletes and coaches out there that are, you know, as capable, if not more capable, than plenty of male coaches and athletes as well. Like, there's, you know, no sort of contest in my mind. I think, you know, there's space for both.
I agree, and also for cats as well, we shouldn't be discriminating.
Yeah, exactly. Fight the fight for cats, people.
Absolutely. So can you talk a little bit about what the similarities and the differences were between your training for Sevilla and Copenhagen?
Yeah, so I think the bread and butter of the week and the structure of the week and what you would call the key days, so your marathon sessions, your long runs, hardly changed really. Back in Reading when I was training for Seville, I did a few more sort of 10K half marathon type sessions when I jump in with the Reading Athletics Club group, just to have some company for my reps, as well as the marathon work. Plus, it being my first marathon, we were constantly sort of experimenting, if you like, and wondering how I'd respond to the volume, to the big sessions, and kind of keying off that. So we were quite conservative with the mileage, kept that on the lower end, definitely for a marathon runner. I think my max week was probably 85 miles. And I did a fair bit of cross training to supplement that. This time around, we knew that I responded quite well to it. So we felt that we could push the mileage up confidently without sort of risking extra, you know, aches and pains or even an injury. And that worked out pretty well. I got up to 98 for my max this time. So quite a big jump. And I was definitely sitting in the sort of mid 80s a lot more comfortably rather than them being, you know, a big week for me last time around. Less cross training. So running more meant that I brought the cross training down a little bit. And this time around as well, not just in the marathon block, but before it, I was doing two gym sessions a week. Brought that down to one a week once we were getting to sort of the business end of the block, just so that my body could feel a little bit better and less tired the days after the gym. But I mean, that was huge because last time around, when I was working and trying to fit everything in, going to the gym and doing my strength and conditioning was absolutely the first thing to go from my schedule, because if I got back from a day working actually in the city and having fitted my first run in the morning, the last thing you want to do is go to the gym, especially if your train's delayed and you get back late, and sometimes it just couldn't happen. So felt really good to be consistent with that this time around, which definitely made me feel just stronger in my running.
It's really interesting you talk about that, because one of the things that I do for my training is that most of my runs are early in the morning, and that's not to do like a Strava or an Instagram flex, like, hey, I'm up before everyone else. But it's more the fact that if I don't do it, like, it's just not going to happen for the rest of the day.
Yeah.
And it has such a knock-on impact, because you go to work, you're sitting at a desk, and like you're saying, you don't want to come back and do your strength and conditioning. So it really does make a difference when you don't have to kind of force the run at a certain point of the day.
Yeah, I find it so difficult at both ends. Like, getting the run done in the morning, if I was commuting into work, would be the hardest part. Would be, as I'm sure you know, just getting up out of bed and out the door. But once you're out, whether it's 6 a.m. or, you know, you're fine once you're out the door. And then I feel like you feel better throughout the day as well, because it's not hanging over you. You've not got to do it when you're even more tired after work. But yeah, you're totally right that once you've been on your feet all day, or even just draining your energy, you know, from working and mentally tiring yourself out, the last thing you want to do is get out the door for a run, especially if it's late and you just want to have dinner and actually chill for an hour.
Yeah. I don't know if this is applicable to you, but when you got to like the 98 miles, did it part of you feel like I should just go out and just do a 2 mile easy just to make it 100?
A little bit. If I was religiously uploading all of my runs to Strava, maybe I'd have felt a bit more peer pressure. But at the same time, I think you get to your max mileage that you've done. So 98 for me. And I felt like I was on the edge. And I thought, yeah. Don't want to go and push myself over it by doing a pointless 2 mile easy run. And I just trust that, you know, next time around, maybe we'll knock on the door of 100 and that'll be cool. But at the same time, it's not going to make a massive difference, like, in how you run the race compared to if you just kept it at 98, you know, as long as it's good quality.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's the best thing, like, not to let your ego get in the way, follow the plan, listen to what your body's saying.
We can get so obsessed with numbers as well. So I think sometimes, like, resisting that temptation is a good thing.
Yeah. And also, I know you mentioned about the content creating side as well, and I'm not just saying this because you're on, but I feel like you're very good at relating to people and people relate really well to you. Can you sort of talk about like how social media sort of ties into like highlighting and developing your own profile? I know you talked about the coaching and stuff.
Yeah, it's a funny one, because I just see it as something that I do now. Like, obviously you've got to put a little bit of thought into it in terms of the YouTube videos. We'll plan what we're doing and kind of map out the next few weeks and work backwards from if I've got a race. That's like the easiest video to film, because people always want to see what you're doing at a race, how it goes, your prep beforehand, how you feel afterwards, etc. And I've just sort of encouraged myself to be really honest with it, which I think, when you say that people find it relatable, to me that's probably why, because I don't sugarcoat anything. If I have an awful day or an awful race and I've completely misjudged it, or I feel like I didn't, you know, live up to my potential, I'll just say that. And not in a negative way of, oh, woe is me, like, I wish I'd run faster and I'm really annoyed and, like, go off and sulk. I always try and be constructive with it and find a positive, not in like a blind way of like, never mind, I'm really happy because I'm not, but, you know, learn from it. And I see it as something that develops as I develop as an athlete. So yeah, I just enjoy sharing what I'm doing. I think I get the impression that people are interested in that, which, you know, if they are, great. Like, let's grow the sport by just sharing what you're doing and giving people a little bit of an insight into how you train, which might be different from how they train. And there might be something that they can then take from that.
Yeah, I agree. Because I feel like the personalities of the runners is something that probably the public and maybe the younger people don't always see. Like, I know we talk about like the night of the 10,000s, but for me, no disrespect, that's kind of tailored towards people who are already invested in the sport, who really love it.
Yeah.
And I sort of find it's harder for people to get involved, because especially when you look at, say, we're speaking to some runners, you know, they might be like, how did the run go? How did the training go? It's very kind of generic answers, probably because there's a lot to protect as well. So they can't always be 100% honest. So sometimes you don't always get that kind of connection between the runners and the public. And I feel like you do that really well. So I'm hoping that obviously other people can kind of learn from that as well and sort of develop it.
Yeah, and look, it's not for everyone to pick up a camera and throw some videos together and put them out there. And I agree with what you say about Night of the 10Ks. Like, it's such a fantastic event, but it is really preaching to the congregation in that it's the running community that turns out. What we want to do is bring more people into that running community. And I saw a really cool article in Athletics Weekly, actually, this week. I think it was Laura Hilliard who was saying something about when you're watching the British Championships or quite a few track and field events, there's a lot of dead time in between kind of when a race finishes and when the next one starts. And we need to try and fill that time with sharing some of the stories about athletes, whether it's something pre-recorded that can go on the screens or some interviews or even a podcast that plays out, as long as it's got like some good visuals to go with it. That would be a really good place to start, so that people can then feel invested in these athletes and know a little bit about their backstory, so that we're not just, you know, seeing who runs the fastest time and then they're the best. Like, you know, there's so much information that you could channel into that to get people a little bit more interested in the actual individual people that are going sort of head to head.
Yeah, I agree with that. That makes a lot of sense. And what you just said there reminds me of kind of like Hassan's, the winner of the London Marathon this year. Like, in the press before, she was talking honestly about not always wanting to train and the fears that she had. And I feel like that doesn't always get seen. It's almost like very robotic. And like you're saying, she's not doing a YouTube channel, but like that content of her speaking for the press was just like, it was gold, because a lot of people can relate to that.
Yeah, and she was so charismatic, wasn't she, in her interviews, and so raw and so honest. And I think sometimes there is a little bit of protecting your kind of, I don't know, where you're at in training. Some people will like to keep the real science or the splits, if you like, kind of hush hush, to keep something in their back pocket, which is fine. But there's other things that you can then talk about that aren't just, yeah, it was good, on to the next one, training's going well, you know, people falling asleep at those kind of interviews.
Yeah, no, I agree. Like I said, I don't think there's like probably like one definitive answer, but I think, yeah, all these things do help. To be honest, like 9 to 10,000 does help, and seeing people's personality, like Hassan's personality, does help. It's just, all that just helps, especially get the young people involved and wanting to take part in sport, really.
Yeah, definitely. And there's a lot of sports that have modernized recently to change either the format of how people watch them or the competitions and the sport themselves. So I think we're starting to see that. It would just be really good to grab hold of that momentum, bring more people into it, and roll with that, really. Otherwise we're going to lose, you know, spectators, and we want to go in the other direction.
Yeah, I agree. Changing gears, I really like your mantra, love the grind. And it kind of reminds me of a bit of what Mike Tyson said previously. Discipline is doing what you hate to do like you love it.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of reminds me of kind of similar type of thing, really, that there's a discomfort, but there's a discipline and the love of that thing. How do those two things kind of like work together for you?
Yeah, I think it's easy to sit here and say, you know, I love running. I love training every day, getting out the door, even if it's raining or snowing or I haven't got enough sleep. Like, I just love it all the time.
Yeah.
That's not the case. But if you can convince yourself that you love it when you hate it, then that's a really strong feeling to hold on to. And I'd much rather do that in a session where I'm battling against the wind or it's not going my way, to remind myself that just showing up and getting it done on those tough days, finishing the session, is going to be way better than giving in and pitying myself. And if you hype yourself up and tell yourself you love it, you enjoy it more anyway by default, because, you know, you do it on those tough days so that you can enjoy it on the days where it all just clicks as well.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to look at it as well. I think you've got to be your own cheerleader as well. And it's just like that discipline is so important, because like you say, you're not waking up every day clicking heels like, I can't wait to do this run or whatever. Sometimes you look at the session like, oh, I don't fancy that today. And it's like, when your why is challenged, like happens to the best of us, we're not always like, I can't wait to do this. Even if the goal is down the road, what you're looking to achieve, it can be tough in those moments. It's just like having those little systems in place where you can talk to yourself and kind of flip those gears and just get moving.
Yeah. And it's a way also to push yourself and look, like, if you want to get faster as a runner, you've got to do those uncomfortable sessions where it really hurts, it's really hard, and every cell in your being is just telling you to stop or to slow down. So it's kind of getting in that space where you're uncomfortable, but you're comfortable being uncomfortable, and you can tell yourself, this is really hard, but I'm okay and I'm doing it. So it's kind of that message as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And what you just said there kind of reminds me of a conversation I had. Joan Benoit Samuelson was there, and she was going to be running the London Marathon last year. So she, I think she had some injuries that she was going through, and she was about to say something, which is like a negative in regards to like just the injuries and things. And she's like stopped herself dead, like mid sentence. And she like flipped it and said, no, I am going to do X, Y, and Z. And for me, that was really powerful, because I was like, even where she is now, she's not competing, but to still have that mindset, that just that like autopilot sort of shows why she was a champion and why she was a pioneer. Have you had any experiences like that where you sort of witnessed other pro runners just do something similar and you thought, wow, okay, maybe I'll take that tool and add it to my toolbox?
Yeah, I think you can see it if you look really hard, but a lot of the time you've trained yourself to think or behave in this way that it does come across natural. But I love watching the field eventers at track and field championships doing their visualization. You'll always see it with the high jumpers. You've got the pole vaulters, long jumpers. They'll do this kind of routine where sometimes they'll close their eyes and they're kind of imagining themselves doing this incredible jump, and sometimes they'll be rubbing their fingers together to bring themselves to the present. And I love watching that, and I love trying to emulate that myself. Obviously with running it's slightly different. I think sometimes the power of visualization is doing it in the weeks and days leading up to a race, not necessarily on the start line, whereas obviously, you know, jumpers and throwers, they've got sort of 3 to 6 attempts at a championship, so they've got to bring themselves back to that calm place in between. But yeah, I've always found that really inspirational to watch, especially when it then goes really well and you're like, wow, you know, the power of the mind along with their physical capabilities have just locked together and done something pretty amazing.
Yeah, that's incredible to hear. And talking to the mind, we're going to touch upon that later in the conversation in regards to some mental techniques that you used in your preparation for the Copenhagen Marathon. But before we get there, I'm not sure if you've probably covered this in previous posts, so apologies if you're rehashing this information again, but in your training, was there a specific workout for Copenhagen that was kind of like the benchmark to sort of see, this is where I am pre-Copenhagen, I know I'm ready, or, you know, I'm not quite ready? Did you have that workout?
There's a really tough one that I did. I must have done it 2 or 3 times in the last block in Seville, and I only did it once this time around, and I was waiting for it and like just constantly asking my coach when it was going to come up. And a couple of times she sort of said, oh, I'm just going to change it, you know, maybe I won't give you that session. And I'm like, no, because I knew it was such a crucial session and just, one of those days that either makes or breaks you. And it was, it's kind of a hybrid between a long run and a session. So the first 10 miles would be at a steady pace, around a minute slower than your marathon pace. And then the second 10 miles, you go straight into that at 10 miles at marathon pace, and then like a couple of easy miles jog on the end. So 22 miles total, but you're picking it up as you go through. practicing drinks. It's kind of the longest chunk of time that I would do at marathon pace. And yeah, always knew that was a big one. So you always want to nail it. Sometimes you don't, but I think sometimes you also don't need to. One day doesn't define you. And I think maybe that's why she was holding off this time around. I had a couple of illnesses in the block, so I don't think I was quite ready to attack that session specifically. I ended up doing it whilst we were away on altitude training. So we kind of adjusted the paces a little bit, which was a little bit like tricky to get your head around, because then you're like, oh, can I still take this as a good sign if I hit these paces? Because these are different paces, but we're also at, you know, 7,000 feet of altitude.
Yeah.
Kind of like trying to figure out how it all works. But yeah, that was probably one of the key ones that I think of.
I mean, that's a sign of a good coach, knowing when to drop that in and when to hold it back as well, from what you're saying. And I was just thinking, when you talked about the 10 miles, minutes lower, and then obviously 10 miles into marathon pace, is that even, or do you have to kind of drop the pace, like progressive?
Yeah, so it's kind of evens across the board. Last time around, I'd be looking at sort of like 6:45 minute miling for the first 10 miles and then into sort of 5:45. And then this time around, I guess, had we been at sea level, we probably would have done sort of high 5:30s to 5:40 for the second chunk and then 6:40 at the start. But it ended up more at sort of like 7 minute miling for the first 10 miles and then 6 minute miling to slightly under for the second 10, just to adjust for the fact that we were altitude. So they say it's sort of like between 10 and 20 seconds per mile at that level of altitude. So you've got to kind of take that off to then be like, okay, this is equivalent to marathon pace at sea level, but there's less oxygen up here.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. And yeah, thank you for sharing that. And moving from altitude into temperature, I mean, both of your marathons have been done in warm weathers. So I struggle in Seville, and I know some people struggle in Copenhagen, but you've had like two great races in running in like hot weather marathons. Can you give like people like myself and other people that maybe struggle some tips?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough running in the heat, but I've always sort of enjoyed it in a weird way. And some people just categorically hate it, but there definitely are things you can do. So the main thing is keeping your core body temperature down. So if you know it's going to be warm, reducing your warm up to the absolute bare minimum. I think I did a mile in Copenhagen and then like one stride, compared to, you know, the session I did this morning. I ran 3 miles to warm up and did two big 200 meter strides, loads of drills. Like I was getting a lot more warmed up than I did for Copenhagen. So just by cutting that down keeps your core temperature cooler at the start. And then taking every opportunity during the race to keep that temperature down, chucking water on yourselves, taking the sponges that they give you, running in the shade, even if it means deviating from the sort of tightest line of the course. I can remember all of the runners doing that on one of the streets in Copenhagen, even though it would have made sense to be on the right for the next corner. Everyone went to the left for this like 1 meter of shade because we all needed it. And if it's a race that's sort of starting later on in the day, something I used in the track season was putting a flannel or a hand towel that had been sort of drenched in water and then wrung out, put that in the freezer and then keep that in a cool bag and then just drape it on you before the race is really effective at keeping you cool. So at least you start off, you know, as cool as you can be, and then hopefully it doesn't take you to that place where you then feel like you're in an oven later on.
That's a great tip. No, thank you for sharing that. And it's interesting to hear about the deviating as well of the course, because, you know, you still ran a great time, but it's just like being strategic about doing that. But then sometimes it's about needs must, isn't it? You want to make sure that you get to the end in a good spot rather than being right in the center and on the race line and flagging.
So. Yeah. And it's about also tuning into how your body feels as well, because, you know, for an easy run on a really hot day, you're going to run slower because it's taking more stress. You know, you're putting more stress on your body by running in higher temperatures.
Yeah.
So, you know, all those little things of making sure you're hydrated and refueling and rehydrating afterwards become even more important as well.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. So we both run using the Chorus Pace 2, and I'm quite interested to know what data fields that you use. I feel like I've got too many data fields in mind, so I need to learn some tips from other people about what's essential stuff that they look at when they're racing.
Yeah, so I did a track session this morning and put it on track mode, and I was scrolling through to try and find what time of day it was so that I knew how long we had left on our slot on the track. And I think I have too many data fields as well, because I was scrolling through and I was like, where's the time? But in normal run mode, I've got on the main screen, I've got distance in miles, pace in miles, and then the cumulative time at the bottom.
Yeah.
And that's the main screen that I'll be on. The second most used screen is just my heart rate. So I'll scroll down, especially when I was at altitude, I tended to just keep it on that screen whilst I was running so that I wasn't basing the run off any sort of pace I wanted to hit, but more so keeping myself in an easy heart rate zone, especially for the easy runs, obviously. And then after that, I've got lap time, lap distance, and lap pace, so that during a session, I'll have it on that screen. Then I've got the time, because you always need to know what time of day it is.
Yeah.
And then I've also got effort pace, average effort pace on there, which can be useful if you're doing a really hilly run and you're not sure whether you're kind of, say you're going for an easy hilly run and you're trying to keep it easy. Going up a hill obviously makes it harder, you know. And we were talking about this out in St. Moritz, actually, because I'd always drop back off the group up a hill to try and keep my heart rate down. And some of the more middle distance focused runners of the group just can't help themselves and they're attacking this hill. So we'd kind of get blown apart on a run. But Jakob Ingebrigtsen supposedly walks up all the hills on his runs. So never be afraid to walk up the hills, people. But yeah, it can be useful sometimes if you're chugging up the hill and your heart rate's going up and you look down and actually the effort pace on your watch that you're running is equivalent to, you know, running a lot faster on flat ground. So yeah, that's the last one that's on there.
I feel like if average effort pace was like a person, it'd be like a friend that gives you a hug, because it always goes, actually, no, you did really well. You ran faster than you thought you did. You're like, thank you.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, definitely picks me up post run as well. So I'm like, oh, well, at least you know the effort's there.
It's always nice when your watch is on your side as well, you know, rather than having negative feedback like that run was rubbish.
yeah, exactly. Because I know a few people, especially for the Carmen, have a little thing about, you know, what it says at the beginning of the run. And it's like, well, just you could switch to Coros, you know, you could.
Yeah. Well, it gives you the suggestion of what to do, or it tells you that you're like detraining. Yeah.
Yeah.
No one needs that in their life.
And I speak to people like, say they've got like kids and they've just, you know, not slept very well. It's like, you don't need that extra bit of abuse from your device.
I know.
You really know. You know. So moving to Copenhagen, let's talk about the mental prep. Now, I know on your Instagram and on your YouTube channel, you do a deep dive into the race. And so I'd advise anyone to look at that first. So I just really just want to talk about just the mental work that went into doing it. So back in when you ran Seville, you talked about the idea that the last 10K was where you felt like you struggled. Can you talk about that moment and any other moments that were like a prompt to thinking, okay, let me work and up my mental game?
Yeah, it's so funny because pretty much everyone I spoke to, you know, friends that I have that have done the marathon and I hadn't at that point, they all told me, you know, don't forget that the real halfway is 20 miles, it's not 13.1. And you sort of sit there and go, yeah, cool, yeah, thanks, that's really useful. And then you go and do the race and you get to 13.1 miles and you go, yeah, halfway. And then you get to 20 miles and then you have this moment where it dawns on you and you're just there thinking, oh, this is what they meant, because this is really hard now. And that last 10K just felt like the longest length of time. And I really struggled to maintain focus on just propelling myself forward during Seville. And I can remember looking down at my watch, seeing that my pace had slipped by 20, 30 seconds. And I was managing to just about keep it there at the worst point. But all I wanted to do was finish the race. I didn't care about what time I ran anymore. I just was thinking to myself, I'm in so much pain. All I want to do is finish this thing. So for the second time around, I had been working with a sports psychologist anyway, just because I thought, this is an area of training that I don't work on. I don't work with a professional. Meanwhile, I'm working on my fueling, I'm working on my nutrition, I'm working on my running training. You know, the power of the mind is so important. Why am I not training this?
Yeah.
So I started working with a sports psychologist. And then when it came to preparing for Copenhagen, that was the biggest thing that I wanted to work on, because I was so scared about the last 10K and that kind of hitting the wall moment. Even if it's not a definitive, you've popped, even if it's, you know, it just gets a lot harder. That was the main thing, really. I wanted to think about how I could mentally help myself get through that when physically, you know, I wasn't quite there anymore.
How did you like mentally not fear it going into the second time? Like, how did you flip it around to be like, actually something not to be celebrated? It's not like Christmas day, but do you know what I mean? It's like, how did you not get to 21 to mile 20 thinking, okay, I'm still okay, rather than is it going to come now
type yeah thing. Yeah, I mean, there definitely was some of that as well towards the last few miles and k's of Copenhagen when I was still feeling good. There were moments where I thought, God, when is this going to hurt? When am I going to blow up?
Yeah.
But preparing for it was a lot of talking through what happened last time and then hearing back from my sports psychologist that, you know, that was one experience and it doesn't mean that every experience is going to be like that, because it won't. I'm going to run loads of marathons and they're all going to be completely different experiences, but also accepting that this is a really hard thing that I'm doing. It's going to hurt and I will get to that place at some point. And just accepting that rather than fearing when it will happen, how bad it will be, and just kind of sitting with it rather than fighting it. That was huge for me.
That's really interesting you talk about that. And also when you think about just the stuff you talked about before, you know, you're, I guess, like if it's like a car analogy, your foot is always on the pedal. You're not easing up. Mm. But then at the same time, you're thinking, I'm giving my max that effort, but am I going to blow up? I'm not saying you're thinking this like the whole time, but it's that real balance. And sometimes it's your day where it goes well, and then some days you're pushing and it's just not your day, and you know, you don't get the result that you would have liked, but that's the result you get on the day, right?
Yeah, and it's this fine balance of pitching it right on the physical side of things, keying off the training that you've done, and for me, sitting down with my coach and going, okay, what's realistic? What are we going to aim for? What other scenarios are there around that, both in how the race can pan out and what time I might run, and then matching that up with my mental strategies as well, so that I kind of had both hand in hand on the same page.
Yeah, that makes sense. Can we take a little step back from the race and talk about some of the things that you worked on in training to kind of prepare for the race? You know, we talk about the mental mindset. I mean, how did you work in the training and sort of build towards what the race day would look like in your mind?
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple of strategies that I practiced in sessions that I then used in the race because they worked really well for me. And for the most part, i.e. before that point where it gets really hard and horrible towards the end, where you're kind of just focusing and trying to be in the zone. And we talk about that flow state, you know, just finding the rhythm and just clicking off the K's. In sessions, I found that place and that feeling by focusing and fixating on the furthest away thing I could see in the distance when I was running a session on a loop, and just staring at it like tunnel visioned and almost thinking about nothing else and just focusing on my breathing and my foot strike and taking in everything that all of my senses were hearing, feeling, smelling, seeing, and focusing on the present. And that to me is what flow state is, where you're kind of, it's just happening around you and you're in the zone. And I then used the positive feelings from that to visualize being in that zone leading up to the race. So, and I've done it so many times that I can literally see this 1K loop that I did so many sessions on out in St. Moritz, because I can remember what each of the things that I would stare at before each like turn were. And there's like this red horse box, and then there's the bollards, and then the corner where the fences are and the bridge. Like, they're just ingrained in my mind because that was all I looked at and thought about throughout the session. So it's kind of zoning out to then be in the zone, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, exactly, because I'm writing notes while I'm listening to you, and that's what it reminded me of, like you zone out, like you said, and to zone back in. And I thought it's really interesting.
Yeah.
I've never thought of it that way, because I think sometimes when, well, I don't know, speaking generally, but like sometimes you might zone, look out in the distance, and it can almost like intimidate you, like it's so far away. Like, you've still got there to go. So I think it's really interesting how you then, what's that transition point between thinking, okay, well, that's there, but I'm here type thing. How do you go from that place?
So for me, the zoning out part of it, it's this dissociation with what you're doing so that you're not focusing on the pace and how hard it is and, you know, how difficult the session is you're doing or how much you've got left. You're zoning out from that. And then when you need to zone back in is when your mind wanders to something else and you start worrying about, you know, the next 5K that hasn't even arrived yet, or your mind is just somewhere else that's not in the present on the session. And that's when I used the like physical, like rubbing my fingers together, what I mentioned earlier that I've seen the field eventers doing, because that brings me to the present, because it reminds me like to feel. And you're rubbing your fingers together and you're literally feeling your own body. So that brings your mind to, how do I feel? I'm okay. I'm in the present. I'm doing this. And I'm focusing on just the bit of the session or the run or the race that I'm doing now. And also checking in with how you really feel. Because if you don't feel great and there's a problem or something specifically hurts, then that's important to pay attention to as well in that moment so that you can then respond to that rather than, you know, ignore it if it's something that needs listening to.
That's super interesting because I'm neurodiverse. So one of the things that I do to sort of self-regulate is, like, say that people call it stimming. So you might have something where you're doing something that keeps your hand busy, or, do you know what I mean? You're turning around. So I never really thought about it in that way, but I use that sometimes to self-regulate if I'm just chilling normally, but I never thought to use that in a race. And I think it's really interesting to hear how that could work for neurodiverse, but also I'm assuming you're neurotypical people as well.
Yeah, I think it can be really powerful because, and you know, there's different things that will work for different people. So people listening to this, like, I just encourage you to try stuff out. And I can remember my dad, he was a runner when he was younger and he did sort of 800s and 1500s on the track. And he used to tell me how to distract himself from the physical pain in his legs. He would pinch himself, like on his arm or on his hands, to then focus on that pain rather than something else. So it's about bringing your attention to where it's helpful to you in that moment. And yeah, it can be used, you know, across loads of different contexts.
I don't know, random thought, but your dad must have like a really strong pinching game to completely distract the pain of a marathon.
He's got scars on his hands.
It goes back like all like a Popeye arm. You're just like, what the hell happened to you?
Yeah.
It was a tough session. random thoughts aside. So one of the other things that you talked about as well was the use of mantras and words. Like, you on your bottle, you talked about the words like rhythm and squeeze and things like that. Can you talk a little bit about those words and how they played into the race?
Yeah. So when we were sort of breaking the race down into different sections, both with the physical race plan and then lining up the mental strategies, we wanted everything to be really simple so that then when you're in a hard place or you're focusing on the running, they're easy to remember and they're words or short phrases that resonate with and work for you. So squeeze for me was one that we used sort of in the second half onwards, where I wanted to squeeze the pace, which meant not turning up the tempo massively, but just like squeezing it onwards a little bit. And I don't know why, but that word's been used in training before for me when I've been in a rep and I want to just squeeze it down ever so slightly and it just hits just right and I know what it means straight away. So, and that's what I needed to hear at that point in the race, you know, all things going well. And then rhythm earlier on, most important thing was that I was just on pace and just clipping it away. Feels like business, feels like rhythm, you know, nothing putting me off of that and just kind of locking in.
Yeah, that makes sense. And sort of following on that point about rhythm and even going back to the point about getting in the flow state, one thing I did find quite interesting was when you talked about how you took the energy from the crowd this time round compared to the first time. And my question for that is, like, how do you manage the energy when you're engaging with the crowd, but also not breaking your focus? How did you best manage that so you don't kind of fall off your target goal?
Yeah, I can see why it might appear like it's difficult to maintain focus when you're also kind of bouncing off the crowd and smiling back, and, you know, even on a couple of instances shouting back later on in the race. It was about kind of canning that in the earlier stages because I didn't need that energy as much, but then also allowing myself to let go of this like rigid, robotic, focused athlete image, because you don't have to be like that. And sometimes it works for people, but sometimes letting yourself smile, or, you know, give eye contact with someone that's watching you that you know maybe, or when someone gives you a big cheer, kind of giving them a fist back, or, you know, responding to that and then receiving even more energy from them. For me, I felt more energized by that. So I didn't feel like I lost any energy from, you know, I wouldn't even say losing focus, but kind of breaking this metronomic kind of furrowed brow look, if you like. But it's balancing it. So obviously you can't do that throughout the whole race. And especially in the earlier stages, if you're constantly shouting back and raising your arms for more cheers, like, it will tire you out. And I think it's something that's best saved for when you need it most and when it gives you that momentum. So for me, it was sort of a little bit of that halfway point, and then for the busier parts of the course later on, and then beyond 35K, I used it quite a lot and it was really effective. And just, yeah, you just feel lifted by it. It's similar to the atmosphere at Highgate, which is obviously consistent throughout because there's people lining the whole track. But there's something really special about just a bunch of strangers often turning up to watch people run a marathon and clearly having respect for the people that are doing it for all different reasons, and just cheering them on and supporting them. And, you know, if you can take even more energy from that by, you know, responding back or just letting yourself absorb it more, then yeah, I'd say try it, because I really think that I ran faster as a result.
But I think you're right though. Like, we don't have to fit that kind of outdated, this is the only way you can be as a runner. Like, we all have to be serious and not look at anyone and not high five, because we're going to be leaking energy. And we're going to crash and burn, right? So,
yeah. And I think, you know, again, everyone's different and different things work for different people. But, and I'm also sure, like, on a hard day, it's probably harder to, you know, let that energy in or to let it carry you. I don't know. I have not been in that place where it's been a bad day. Obviously, there were points in the marathon where it got really, really tough towards the end. But if I told myself to smile and tried to absorb all of that energy, you know, it worked. It's easier to smile than it is to, you know, frown and sit back and down in your stride. So, yeah, I think it takes a little more energy to put yourself in that place when it's tough. But it's definitely worth doing. Otherwise, you're just missing out on such an amazing atmosphere.
Yeah. And I think there's so many tools in your toolbox. We talked about this side, but you've also talked about the importance of your granddad and picturing seeing him running and seeing you run alongside. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So when I got on to the point of, you know, this hardest point in the race, which last time around was from 10K onwards, you know, it's going to be in those closing miles. I wanted my sports psychologist to just tell me what to think about. That's what I wanted. I was like, just tell me what to think and I'll think about that and it'll be great. And she was like, well, it kind of has to come from you. And at that point, when it gets really, really tough and you're physically hurting all over and the odds are against you and you just want to slow down, that's kind of when all of the practical, physical, scientific strategies, the rhythm, the flow, the counting, the fixating on something in the distance, they all go out the window, because what's stronger than that is the pain that you're in. So then you have to go somewhere that's even stronger than that, which is your emotions. So thinking about something that will elicit a positive response from you and get you to dig deeper than you think you physically can. So thinking about, you know, who you're doing this for, why you're doing this, or something that kind of evokes that goosebumps feeling is what you want. And she just told me to kind of think about what that might be for me. And that it just happened on the day. I literally could see him cheering me on. And it's not like a, you know, figment of my imagination thing. I was visualizing him there, cheering me on. Obviously, he wasn't, but it just that little moment. I didn't need to constantly think about that. It was just enough to remind me, like this one's for my granddad, and I want to dig deep and run really well for him. Because he got on well at the start of the year whilst I was in Flagstaff on training camp, and we were a little bit worried that he was going to pass away whilst I was there. And my dad spoke to him and he said, don't let her come home. You know, I want her to train. Tell her to go and run that marathon. If I go while she's away, I don't want her to come back. And thankfully it was a little bit later on that he passed away. So I was able to see him one more time and to go to the funeral, but that kind of stuck with me. So I think, I used that to a positive effect in the race itself.
Well, sorry to hear about your grandfather passing away, and thank you for sharing that as well. I think just listening to what you said there and going back to the start, it's a really interesting point that when it comes from you, that was pertinent to this point in your life. Now, that won't always be exactly the same for the next marathon. And I guess it's about being in tune to what that little extra bit of fire is for you in that particular point of your life.
Yeah, and what means something to you. You know, there's loads of things that you can pull on, even kind of searching for what that is before the race by watching other inspirational sports performances or races and kind of keying off that, or watching that so many times that it's ingrained in your head. And when it gets really tough, you visualize, you know, I don't know, Paula Radcliffe finishing that London marathon when she broke the world record, like something that's a really powerful image, so that it shines through when all you can think about is the pain that you're in. And you've got to find something that lets you push past that, because at that point it has to come from your mind. Your body's done what it can for you. So you've got to kind of find, that thing that helps you dig deeper.
That makes a lot of sense. Is there, I know we talked about some of the mental stuff that, you know, works, but can you talk about some of the things that you tried during the race and you thought, this is not working for this particular moment?
Yeah, I'm not sure if I had anything that I tried during the race that didn't work, because most of the strategies that we decided on were things that had worked for me in training. There were also things that we discussed that I thought I was going to use that I didn't. Like I'd written all of these little messages on my bottles, like just one or two words. And I think I only looked at like two of them because I was so focused on just grabbing the drink, drinking the drink and chucking it away. So some of those little messages to myself were lost on the streets of Copenhagen. But there are a couple of strategies that I'd tried in training before that didn't really work for me, like a different way of dissociating and zoning out, like on a run or in a session, was to like count different things that you see. So like counting the cars that go past or counting the trees that you pass. I always found that counting my steps up to four and then repeating, or doing this kind of focusing in the distance, worked better for me than those strategies. But for some people, those will be the killer strategies that get them through. So there's so much out there.
Yeah, that's fair. And I think it's interesting to hear that. I think just for context, so people would want to know that as well, just to know that there was a process of things that worked. And like you said, you had some things that were working alongside, but some things you focus on more, like you're saying with the bottles, that you didn't need to go into that side because you had the other bits which you can lean into more, but you never know on the day, it could have been the other way around. So it's good to have all those things in place rather than going into it with less, like nothing.
Yeah, and it's a little bit like the training sessions that you do, and you know, testing out what gels and drinks work for you. Like it's all trial and error, and you don't know whether it will or won't work for you until you've tried it. And if you try something out and it doesn't work first time, maybe try it again. But if it doesn't work again, that's fine. But the work that you've put into it has told you that that's not the one to focus on, which is really useful information. It's never time wasted.
Yeah. I know we've spoken about sort of like the focus and the race itself, but there's that moment beforehand. So, for example, I was looking at Carla Molinaro's post, and she talked about watching some musicals in the build-up towards Comrades, which is going to be this Sunday. But when this comes out, it'll be later. So for me, like, I love to watch comedies or things that make me laugh probably like the day before the race, just to keep me relaxed. And then race day, I can kind of turn the focus on to what I need to, rather than always being like pent up and like, do you know what I mean? Like, I'm gonna crush this. It's like, you're going to be fine, mate. You need to chill out. Just let it go for the race. Do you have any moments like that where you kind of almost have to relax? What do you do to relax first before you go into the kind of that that place for the race.
Yeah, you definitely, in the days leading up to it, you don't want to fixate on your race plan and read through all of these tools that you're going to use like as if it's an exam. Like, you're just going to stress yourself out if you think about it constantly. So yeah, I would agree. Distract yourself. I really like to be with people. So either if I can find other athletes in the race that are like me and like to be with other people beforehand. Some people would like to be just shut away in a room to watch their musicals in peace. but I like to be with friends and family and kind of distract myself in that sense and talk about things that aren't the race. And yeah, I'm partial to watching a few rom-coms on Netflix or whatever it is on my watch list, I suppose. Anything to kind of pass the time quickly, because that day before the race is probably the most painful. And if you can do things that are useful, I spent like 2 hours dressing up my bottles in some sort of art attack spin-off. that was good fun as well.
Oh, that's brilliant. Did you actually have like the theme tune of Art Attack playing whilst you were doing it? Just to
No,
add that,
so I should have done though, because I had my pipe cleaners out and my different coloured duct tape and my stickers. It was great fun, yeah.
I want to move on to the listeners' questions. So thanks for everyone that submitted questions. Marcus Benito and Martin Edwards asked, what is next after 229?
What's next? So in the immediate future, I am going into track mode and running some much shorter distances. Going to do a few 5Ks, a few 3Ks, maybe a couple of 1500s on the track. And then the next big road race for me is the London Big Half in September.
Laura asks, what was your favourite thing about Copenhagen?
I got to say the crowds, because they were just fantastic.
Brilliant. Sophie's got two questions. The first one is Marmite, yes or no?
Absolutely yes.
And the second one is, how do you not go mad whilst tapering?
I don't. I do go mad. I went pretty insane. I was anxious about the reduced volume I was doing and probably not a very nice person to be around. But same as preparing for the race, working with my sports psychologist to accept those very natural and normal feelings and just try and distract yourself really and remind yourself that the work is done. But yeah, those 2 weeks leading up to a marathon are probably the worst part of the block, to be honest.
Yeah, it's very heightened, isn't it? And it's almost like, I think a lot of people think that it's just them, but it's a common thing across the board, no matter how fast or slow you run a marathon.
Yeah.
Rose asks, I think this actually relates to Seville as well, because I remember you used a caffeine gel. Did you use a caffeine gel at the end of this race?
I used a third of a 100 milligram caffeine gel before the race in Copenhagen, which is much less than I used during the race in Seville.
Okay. I love the Pacific nature, one third, no more.
I know, trust me. Well, I practiced a lot. So I've got the OTE caffeine gels and they're 100 milligrams. And on one training run, I took a full one beforehand, didn't work out. I threw up during the run. Then I tried half a caffeine gel and I still felt a little bit sick. So I cut it down to a third and that was my Goldilocks measure.
Okay. Simon asked, we've partly covered some of this before actually about you signing to New Balance, but I guess the second part of the question is that I've not asked is, who is your running role model?
I've said this before and I think it's probably my coach, because as a coach myself and as an athlete, there's so much that I look up to in what she does and how she spins all those plates and has done some of the amazing things that she's done in her career, like being British record holder and winning medals on the world stage.
And I guess there's lots of bits of just it's not just the training that you're getting in terms of just like, there's the workouts, but all the conversations that you have from the experience that she's got that can help you navigate where you are as well.
Yeah. And it makes you feel confident when it's coming from someone who's literally been there. So you can kind of trust what she's saying more than, I don't know, if it was just Joe Bloggs.
Destin asked, how did you feel in being prepared and your confidence in the training leading up to Copenhagen?
I felt really good. The last few weeks, especially spending a month out in St. Moritz, just it instilled so much confidence in me, because I was just ticking along, not having any issues, feeling good in sessions. And I took a lot of confidence from that and reminded myself to take confidence from that, because that's the best confidence you can get, really, is knowing that training's going well for the thing you're training for. And then, yeah, that's kind of the hardest bit, really.
Yeah, that's fair. Vanessa asks, and this is a wider question to, I guess, the running community. As someone who doesn't have access to a track club, what advice would you give to runners to be able to connect with other runners?
Oh, that's a difficult one, because that would be my first port of call, is join your local athletics club. Find other runners in the area. Like, if there isn't a track or an athletics club near you, I'm sure there's other runners that are looking for company. So use your social media sites, your Facebook, to search for those runners and connect and make your own running club. I mean, there's a pub just down the road from us that meets for a run club on Tuesdays and Thursdays, just around the village, which I think is really sweet.
Yeah, and it's a great way to connect with the community as well. Alex asks, have you always taken strength training seriously, or only at a certain point?
Definitely not. My first introduction to strength training was when I got to Oregon, and I was so detrained in the strength sphere that I was with the freshmen using like a wooden pole to learn the movements, even though I was, I don't know, 23 or 24, however old I was. So no, I never really focused on it. And it wasn't until I had a plan built and highlighted some of my weaknesses, which unsurprisingly were linked to the recurring injuries that I had, that I then learned how important it was. And yeah, like I've said, time sometimes is the issue for not fitting it in. But even if it's just sort of 10 minutes in the evening in front of the telly or doing some band exercises, it goes a long, long way.
And some people really detest the strength work, and some people love doing it alongside it. Are you kind of in the middle, or in one or the other camp?
Some and some, but I think I've been won over. Like, most of the time, I have a great time in the gym. We all go together as athletes from the team, which helps having company to make you feel more comfortable and to also help each other out. Like, if you're lifting a bar onto someone or just spotting them. And it adds a new dimension to your training. So if a session hasn't gone very well, a run hasn't gone very well, you can have a good gym session. So yeah, I like it.
Yeah, it makes sense. I think, yeah, doing it with other people definitely makes it easier, because you all feel accountable, like you're in there together. So I think that's really cool to hear. The last question is from Hannah. When did you finally think, maybe running's for me, I have imposter syndrome?
That's a tricky one. I can remember being a youngster running for my athletics club and wanting so badly to be as good as Jess Judd, who used to win the English schools races by a country mile, and I'd come sort of a hundredth or thereabouts. And I really didn't believe that I would ever get to that level, or you know, or to where I am today even. And I don't know why I carried on not thinking that I'd get there, but it was once I got to uni and I started to see that I was making improvements from putting the hard work in, that little by little I could keep doing that and it would all add up. So I think it comes back to focusing on the enjoyment of it, because I stuck it out during those times when I didn't really rate myself or think that I'd ever amount to much, that I did it because I enjoyed it. So focus on that, and also know that if you run, you're a runner. You've heard it before and it sounds really cringy, but it's true. Like, it doesn't matter whether you run for 1K or a mile or once a week or every day. You know, if you run, you're a runner, even if it's running for the bus.
Yeah, that makes sense. And just something I was thinking about in terms of that imposter syndrome thing, I guess, I don't know if this applies to you or not, but I guess sometimes it can fuel you, but sometimes it can just fall off you. Do you find that you could sort of go between those two camps sometimes?
Yeah, I try to focus on what I'm doing and what I can control, rather than comparing myself to where I stand up against others or in the country, etc. Because you can't control what other people are doing. So if that makes you feel like an imposter because you're not as fast as someone else, that feeling is going to win. Whereas if you focus on yourself and try not to give into these feelings of proving other people right, but actually setting your own goals that are yours and make sense for you, then there's something really healthy there to focus on.
Yeah, it's like minimizing the some of that excess noise, which doesn't help your give you the best that you can on that day.
Yeah, exactly.
No, that makes sense. And I can't believe we've not talked about the merch as well. Can you talk about the new t-shirts as well?
Yeah, so we, myself and my partner Daniel, we launched merch for the YouTube on a website on Sunday. It's blown up compared to what we thought would happen. We just hoped that a few people would buy some of the t-shirts and the posters, but it's gone down really well. Unfortunately, we found yesterday that there's quite a few scam websites that have stolen the designs and are listing them as Philly Bowden merch, which they are not. So if anyone's interested in buying the merch, please get it through my YouTube or from phillybowdenmerch.com. But yeah, it's been a long time in the works, lots of hard work from Daniel building the website and working with a fantastic designer called Phil, who made us some really cool Love the Grind designs. And yeah, it's been good fun to see it come to fruition.
Sorry to hear about that. But yeah, it's great to see that, like, it's picking up and obviously it's connecting with people, because I think, yeah, it's a great thing. It's really well designed. And for the people that don't follow you, can you share your Insta profiles or your other social media profiles so people can get involved?
Yeah, I'm on Instagram and YouTube as Philly Bowden with just the one L. Lots of people think I've got two L's, but it's just the one. I also have a TikTok, but I don't post very often on TikTok. I don't really get it. I'm trying to figure out how to make good videos on TikTok, but I'm on there. I think it's the same name.
You've got to up your dance skills, I guess, isn't it? I don't know.
I'm not in the right generation. I feel like I need to speak to some teenagers and figure it out.
I don't know. Actually, that might even be like my sort of narrow-mindedness, because I think we've kind of gone over the kind of dancing and pointing stuff. You know, a lot of it is actually quite funny. You know, sort of like short clips you see on TikTok, but it's just like, it's creating it. I think people just assume that you just like rock up with a camera and just like it just happens, but yeah, there's a lot of prep that goes into it.
Yeah, and everyone seems to post so often, so I just don't understand how people have the time to make 3 videos a day.
Yeah, that, it's crazy. But Philly, thank you for coming back to a Runner's Life podcast. I think you're the first athlete that's come back twice, so no, I appreciate that. So no pressure for your third upcoming marathon PB down the line.
Hey, thank you for having me back. I think this is the first podcast that I have returned to, so it feels like a full circle moment, although lots more to come. So yeah, maybe I'll have to make it a tradition that I catch up with you after each marathon. You might have a lot of episodes on me at that point.
No, that'd be awesome. No, it's great to be connected, and thank you for, you know, coming back and chatting with me on a Runner's Life podcast.
Thank you for having me.
I don't know why I just clapped. I just clapped myself. I'm like, who the hell am I clapping for?
I do that. I do that in videos where I'm like, right. And then I'm like, Daniel's like, can you do that again and not clap, please? Because it's going to ruin the audio. And I'm like, sorry.
It's just like, thank you for listening to this episode of A Runner's Life podcast. If you've enjoyed this conversation, please do subscribe to be notified of new episodes. If something resonates with you, please let me know and share online. Also, you could do me a massive favor by leaving your review on the podcast platform which you selected, as it helps the podcast grow. Your support helps make this podcast possible. If you've got any questions, please do get in touch with me on my Instagram page at Marcus_runs. Your time is valuable. Thank you again for sharing your time with me.